Good morning. I think it's about time to get started. I hate to interrupt conversations, but it is time, and apologize for pushing the time limit myself. I had Jonathan with me this morning, which I'm blaming him, but I'm not really. I did stop to get him a treat on the way here, and it took longer than I thought it would, so I apologize. But it's for a good cause. As y'all can see, my wife has returned. Yay. I am so happy she's back. Life just got easier. And I kind of like having her around. So, a little prayer of thanks for Michelle making it back safely, and they had a good time down in Florida. And don't want to go into too many details because internet people never know. So before we begin, does anybody have any prayer requests that they'd like to mention? Nothing? Okay. Well, if you will, go ahead and bow with me. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this beautiful day that you've given us, for this wonderful time that we have to come together and to study your word and to help each other to gain a better understanding of what it is that you want us to know from your parables that you've shared with us, Father. Father, I ask that you bless us. We ask that you bless the study, and we ask that you bless us as we go into our worship. We praise your Son's holy name. Amen. Okay, so last week, I got here announcements. Patrick should be back next week. So he'll take back over, and we're going to today finish with the unjust steward. So it'll take up most of the time. We may cut just a little bit early, but we'll just kind of follow the conversation, see where it takes us. The next two parables I'm going to talk about when I take my turn again is going to be the rich fool, which you can read about him in Luke chapter 12, verse 13 through 21, and then the barren fig tree, Luke 13, 1 through 9. So those will be the next two parables that I will talk about when I have an opportunity to come up here if you want to read ahead.
You say the rich fool and
the rich fool and the barren fig tree. Both of them in Luke. One is 12, 13 through 21. That's the rich fool. And Luke 13, 1 through 9, the barren fig tree. Okay, so I left off last week kind of implying that there was a lot of money that we were talking about. I don't know about y'all, but I don't trade in wheat. I don't trade in oil. So I kind of wanted to put that in terms of what we're talking about. Now, keep in mind, and I'll come back to this in a little bit, but the people that's in his audience is not just his disciples. Who are the other basically three categories of people that are there with him, that are listening? Tax collectors and Pharisees. Now remember, the Pharisees also said that there was another group that was there that they kind of looked down on, and the sinners, okay, general, I'd say common folks. But those are the people who were in that room. So when I'm starting to talk about this money that Jesus was referring to, or this wheat and this oil that he's referring to, there is a substantial dollar value associated with this. Okay, so first let's start with, what is a denarius? The daily wage, or the wage for daily labor. So that's one day's worth of money, all right? So plural of denarius is denarium. No, denaria. Okay, that comes into play when I start going through the math. I'm going to make this really quick. I love math. Most people hate it. My wife and I, we don't see eye to eye on math. I like math. Okay. So how much money are we talking? So that, now what I'm going to give you is the information that I got from Rushmore. That's his name, right? Lewis Rushmore, from his books. So the first one was a hundred measures of oil. A hundred measures of oil was about 800 gallons. The yield of 146 trees. olive trees. That's how much oil we're talking about. So it's the cost or the value of it was about 1,000 denarii. So he paid 20%. He took 20% off. So 20% of the 800 denarii. No, he took 50% off. I'm sorry. He took half. So it's 500 denarii. Whew. I should have practiced more on the math before I started talking about it. It's 500 denarii. Now, the second fella was the oil. The oil was 100 measures. I already said oil, didn't I? The wheat, 100 measures, which is yield of about 100 acres, which is worth about 2,500 denarii. So it's a lot more money for the wheat for the total number of measures, but he only took 20%. Now, 20% of 2,500 is 500. So in both cases that we're talking about, it's 500 denarii. Denarii. 500 denarii for a total of 1,000 denarii. Whew. For the two individuals that he mentions here whose debt he forgave a portion of. Now, the reason why I get into the math is to give you an idea dollar-wise. Because what we're talking about, and remember, they work 6 days a week, right? So that's 313 days a year. I had to get the calculator. I didn't just know that. So we're talking about 313 days, working days a year. So 1,000 denarii is a little over 3 years of labor. 3 years of daily labor for a person. And that's assuming that they work every single day. A Jew worked every single day that he was able to. Right? So we're talking about 3 years worth of labor for just those two individuals. Now he doesn't mention the other debtors. So we don't know if the other debtors were honest and didn't want to go along with it, or if more than likely the other debtors also had debt that were forgiven, at least portions of it, and Jesus just didn't go through list obviously all the debtors, nor did he give a total amount, right? Okay, so the question is, I shouldn't say it as a question. I won't make it a statement. You realize then how much these tax collectors would have known, even without somebody going through the numbers like I just tried to do, how great a debt this really was, how much money we're really talking about. So it was a large amount of money that we're talking about that Jesus mentions that the steward forgave them of, or the steward worked with them to write off, basically. Okay, so the tax collectors would have known that. Why would this have been important to the Pharisees? Why would they have known? Let me rephrase that. Why would that have been of interest to the Pharisees? I'll put it like that.
They liked money.
Absolutely. And we're going to get into that later, actually, in verse 14. They loved money. If you look at, matter of fact, I'm going to bring it up now, verse 14. Now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, also heard all these things and they derided them. We're going to come back to that in a little bit.
Where are we at?
I'm sorry. Well, right now we are at verse 7 and 8. We're talking about where the steward, oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Luke chapter 16. I knew what verse I was on, kind of. All right. Okay, what was my point? I actually had a point. Okay, they were lovers of money, and all these people were in the audience. Now, verse 8, before I get to verse 8. Here's a food for thought, something to think about. Up till now, most of the parables that we read, there's at least one moral person. There's at least one good person. God is represented, kingdom is represented. But all three of these people are a bit like rascals. Now, the two that are obvious rascals, right, two groups, are the steward himself, right, and the debtors. But how is the master, the manager, the landowner, how is he kind of a rascal? Now, we know that his steward just gave away 3 years worth of, 3 years labor worth of debt. And what did the master say?
He commended him.
He kind of commended him. He said, good on you. Look what you did. Good on you. Now, I don't want to get too far into the weeds on that, and I'll tell you why here in a little bit. But the main thing is that there's no moral person in this parable. And that's kind of why I chose it, because that makes it kind of hard to deal with, doesn't it? Because when we read parables, a lot of times we're looking for what's the moral behavior that I'm being taught with this parable. But Jesus is not teaching a moral behavior here. He's actually kind of teaching a worldly behavior that we can learn from. Not saying that we can be moral by emulating the immoral behavior of people who are worldly. Not by emulating their immoral behavior, but there's some principles here that are really important to us as Christians. And this is a hard one to deal with for me. I really had to study on it. Okay, so in my notes I just put here, it appears that Jesus makes no ill judgment on these guys. Not one of them. He doesn't take the time to talk about how immoral their behavior is, even though they're clearly immoral. That's why I was saying before, I mentioned before, that the point of his using this parable is not to say this is moral behavior, that anybody in this acted morally, because he didn't. Even the master, he didn't say, I forgive you for acting that way to teach us forgiveness. He didn't even say that. He kind of elbowed him and winked at him and said, okay, great job. You really, you got one on me. Okay. So the morality is not the point. And it's not the first time that has been used. And I don't want to get too far into the weeds on this, but if you look at Matthew chapter 10, verses 16, Jesus tells his apostles to be wise as serpents, right? So serpents are not treated as something that is commendable in the Bible. Luke 18, verses 1 through 8, that's where Jesus also provides a parable talking about the unjust judge. If you remember, he's the one who kind of ignores the lady who's going to him trying to get justice. But finally, he gives in and gives her justice because, not because it's right, but just to get her to shut up, right? Jonathan or Sammy, I wasn't supposed to say that. So to get her to be quiet, to get her to leave him alone. So it's not an uncommon idea of using something that's not necessarily moral behavior in order to teach a moral. So after the master commanded the steward, Jesus states in verse 8. So the master commended the unjust steward because he had dealt shrewdly, and says, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in their generation than the sons of light. And that's kind of the heart of the message. And if you hear what he's saying there, then you get what the parable is about. He's not talking about morality. He's talking about, I just said the word, right? Shrewdness. That being able to look at a problem and finding your way through it, being able to look at what was going to happen to the steward soon. It's going to be terminated, and basically an end to everything that was going on, and he found a way out of it. Now, it's not about finding a way out of it. It's about understanding that the life that we have now, the world that we have now, will end. Right? We cannot live forever. The world will end, or we will end before the world ends, one or the other. No, that's the only two options we have. And Jesus is saying here, you need to prepare for that. Now, it sounds like it's a bit of a leap to get there, to say that, but that is what he's saying. He's saying this is not, you've got to be shrewd, and that's what he's saying. In other words, when you're stewarding your things, when you're stewarding the things that belong to God, it's not yours. Keep that in mind. So, yes, sir.
He was looking at things that were eternal versus...
Right. He's talking about... And that's the hard part for me that I had trouble, because I had trouble keeping up because it was going back and forth between the two. But that is what he's saying, is that... He's taking a principle that they would understand.
Right. It wasn't the value of the oil or anything about that. That's just a consumable. He has no interest in that. What the steward did to get eternity, I mean, well.
Yep. No, you're okay. And I don't know if I want to get off on this. Did we mention last week, did I ask the question, what was he expecting to get from the debtors? Did I ask that question? What was he supposed to get in return? Because I know at the end we ran out of time, kind of. And I
don't remember. And he'll be fired. He thinks he's going to be accepted by them. Yeah.
Okay. Accepted by them. Allow. Basically, lean on their hospitality. Was he expecting work? I don't think so either. I don't think he was expecting work, because he had already demonstrated to them that he could not be trusted. He demonstrated them specifically he could not be trusted because of the way he treated even them against his master.
Because he was of age, he said he couldn't be.
That's right.
So maybe somebody would have mercy on him and take him in. You know?
Okay, I got to be careful. I'm going to go backwards. I don't want to do that. Okay. That's on me. So, verse 8's the hinge pin because of that. See, proactive and prepare for what's coming. Okay, so verse 9. So before I move on, does anybody have any comments on verse 8 again before I move? Because I know I might be moving too quickly. I've had too much coffee already. No? Okay, so let's go ahead and look at verse 9. Now, verse 9 I had a lot of difficulty with. And the reason is because I looked at verse 9 the first time completely out of context. I just read it by itself. And then I realized you've got to put verse 9 in the context of what he's doing here. So verse 9, and I say to you, make friends for yourselves for unrighteous mammon, that when you fail, they may receive you into an everlasting home. So verse 9 was difficult for me because it sounded like it was saying, you know, make friends with money people so that they're going to take care of you then. But that's not really what he's saying, because... He's continuing with that imagery that he's already started with verses 1 through 8 of chapter 16. Right? He's talking about the shrewdness of people using their money and learning from that to be able to prepare yourself for the future.
Okay. No, I'm just...
Is that... Okay.
Because I think I've had the wrong idea about verse 9, too, and I'm listening very intensely of what you have to say. But go ahead.
Go ahead. I want to hear.
No, I'm
okay.
Yeah.
All right. So the other thing that I read that I found interesting is that Jesus doesn't say if you fail. He says when you fail. Mm-hmm. So I have to be careful what I say, because Mr. Rushmore is actually quoting, Mr. Rushmore brings out the point that when Jesus says this, he's talking about basically when you die. Okay, I'm not sure I completely agree with that. I will say that we do have an end to our lives, and that when the end of our lives comes, that's when... That's when, if we are shrewd, meaning if we plan, if we prepare, if we're dedicated, if we use our talents for God, then we have the opportunity to go to heaven. I don't know if I followed that correctly. Okay, but the main thing is on that is when you're reading that verse to put it in context with the entire parable, that he's making that comparison between people who shrewdly deal with the world and to look at that behavior and idea and to apply that idea of being prudent. That's what I was looking for, being prudent and making good decisions on how you spend your time and how you spend, let me rephrase that, how you spend God's time and how you spend God's money and how you spend God's property that you are stewarding. Okay. Did I hear someone? Okay. Okay, so verse 10, he goes on to add, he who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much, and he who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much. So what is the concept that he's talking about here? And I'm trying to remember if Patrick was one who mentioned this in his class a couple of weeks ago. So what's the principle he's talking about? If you're unjust in little, you're unjust in much.
If you don't use your spiritual talents to excel in this world, why should I trust you with more in eternity?
I think we might get to that a little bit more, like in 11 or 12.
Okay.
I think you're getting ahead. You're already getting to the bottom line. Oh. But you're on the right track. Okay. You're right there. If I keep using my children as examples, I shouldn't, since they're in the room with me. But if I know that someone is cheating on a test, and I caught them cheating a little bit, then I'm going to know or believe that they're cheating a lot, that I just haven't caught them. Does that make sense? And it's the same principle. The thing that makes it a little difficult for me is if you're okay. We don't like to be judgmental, so that's why it's difficult for me to deal with this verse. So for me, I have to make it more about myself. I have to make sure that I understand that if I'm being unjust, I'm going to be seen as unjust, because everybody's going to be able to see that. And that's the judgment that we make on ourselves. On each other. Yes, sir.
Well, a lot of times, particularly in today's world, people that are a little bit unjust are not really looked at that way by the world. Because in reality, if I cheat you out of a nickel, it's not really any different than if I cheated you out of $1 million.
Morally.
To God.
Right, to God, okay.
And that's what we're supposed to worry about, because a lot of times today you hear it every day. Well, you know, is what he did really that bad? You know, yeah. And this, yeah. And well, yes, it is. To God, it is. And that's what's important. And most people don't have any idea of that.
And I think what I'm thinking about is the parable of the two sons. One says, I'm not going to do it. Then he goes back and does it. And that's that, and the one that says I will do it, but then he doesn't do it. So which one was the more obedient, or which one was the obedient son? And I think it falls along that principle that if you're choosing what you're going to do right, then you're not really doing right. Does that make sense? In other words, if it's a choice for you, if it's not, I'm doing right because it's the right thing to do. And then, no, that's double talk, because we all can choose to do right and choose to do wrong, right? Mm-hmm. But, okay.
I am very confused.
Yes, ma'am.
I have no idea what we just talked about. I thought I knew what it said, and then that conversation just made me very confused.
The so verse 10? Well, no, verse, yeah, who is faithful in what is least is faithful also in much, and who is unjust in what is least is unjust also in much.
All right, so our conclusion of that verse was what?
The conclusion on that verse is that wait, let me check my notes before I make this up as I go. I think I was just following the principle that that brain dead. Yes, sir. Can you help me out?
If you're unjust, you're unjust. Whether it's, like I said, whether you forgive somebody a dollar against your master's will for whatever reason, or whether you help somebody steal $1 million. If you are unjust to God, you are unjust, period. And just because we might think it's a little thing doesn't mean that it is to God. Because either you are or you're not. That's like basically the same thing it says, we're being faithful in a little thing, or being faithful in a great thing. If you're not faithful in a little thing, then you're unfaithful, period.
Yeah.
And it's hard to look at it that way, but that's the way it is to God.
Yeah.
Okay.
The concept of a lie is a lie.
Say again, ma'am.
No. So what now?
Bringing it down to, I was just making sure. Just the concept that a lie is a lie, good is good. God doesn't gauge.
It's not like the little white lie.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Of course. You're coming to a head on this now, yeah.
Sorry, I might have went off on a tangent on that one. So just to repeat for the people who are on the internet, the principle that's being taught here is the idea that there's no such thing basically as a little lie. There's no such thing as being a little unfaithful. That if you are being unfaithful, then you're being unfaithful with as a steward of God's property. Blessings. Okay. Verse 11. Therefore, if you've not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? So what are the true riches he's talking about?
Spiritual riches. Spiritual riches.
Spiritual riches. Okay.
So, if you are not faithful in unrighteous, so here in this world, God give us riches.
Okay. All right.
And if we, this is the way I can kind of understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if we are not faithful with the physical things that we have, because we're supposed to be good stewards over physical things, money. If we are not faithful over that, how can God give us the true riches? How can we be faithful over true riches? And I know in my own life, I'm equating the two. God has blessed me to have some riches, some money, more than I need. And thanks be to God that I'm willing to open up my hand and give it back to his kingdom. And
okay,
believe it or not, as a result of that, he truly is blessing me with true riches. And some of those are peace of mind, and no amount of money can buy that.
Nope.
Health, no amount of money can buy that. So, bottom line up front, what I'm experiencing is, if I'm willing to give of my monies, because that's what mammon is from what I understand, if I'm willing to give it back to him, he is willing to bless me with true riches. Does that make sense? I mean, that's what I'm experiencing.
I understand what you're saying.
In my walk with the Lord.
I understand. So what I got from that is basically, if we are faithful with how we deal with riches and things that we're blessed with, then we will continue to be blessed in ways beyond just money. Okay? All right. I can go with that. I'm not sure that that's... Ma'am?
Yeah, I was going to apply. I mean, I think that he's talking about, and we already talked about verse 9.
Yep.
He's not saying, like, you know, this is what you should do. You should follow mammon so that you can, you know, end up with dwelling eternally with them. He's just saying, if you follow mammon, you'll end up dwelling eternally with them. And so when he goes into these verses, he's talking about if you can't say you can't love your neighbor, then how can you love God? If you can't do something small, like just loving your friend, then how can you do something big like loving God?
Okay.
That's a point.
That's a good point. Any other comments? So, when I was looking at this, what I saw in this, talking about who will commit to your trust the true riches, that's what I kind of focused on, is the idea that if you're not taking care of those things that you are trusted with, then how can you expect to be trusted with more? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. It's along the same lines of what y'all were talking about. But for me, I kind of saw it in the idea of individuals, like the people that you're around every day. They see how you're behaving with the properties and the things that we're supposed to be stewards of. Then how can they trust you when you start talking about the true riches? When you start trying to get them to commit to the true riches. Okay. All right, verse 12. And if you have not been faithful in what is another man's, who will give you what is your own? Who will give you what is your own? Does it sound like it's basically the same thing that he's talking about before? Like, if you are not taking care of other people's stuff, how can you have what is your own? So we already know that whose stuff is it that we have?
God's.
Right, it's God's stuff. And that's kind of the principle that I read into this. I'll admit that I'm reading into this, that he's talking about, that this is God's property that we are stewards over. So verse 13 is the one that's pretty commonly referred to or referenced. He says, no servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. So mammon here is, of course,
money,
mankind, worldly.
Safe to say physical wealth?
Mammon. That's kind of belongs in that category. So, what is the idea when he's talking about no servant can serve two masters? Has anybody here worked for two employers at the same time?
Yes.
What do you run into? Conflict? Especially in this situation, obviously, right? Because these are completely opposite. There's no middle of the road. And that's kind of what I wanted to mention. If you look at verse 8 and you marry that into verse 13, is that there's really no middle ground, right? Because it's either you are sons of light or you are, what was the word, sons of the world. And that's an important thing to remember, is that you can't be... You can't, there's no gray area in this. There's no middle road on this one. Okay. So verse 14, I alluded to this before. Now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, also heard all these things, and they derided him. So why did they deride him? Not just because they loved money, but what is it about their love for money that would make them want to deride Jesus for having said this?
Their whole perspective on life is different.
Their whole perspective on life is different. Okay.
They focus on the world and the things in the world, And they don't understand anybody that doesn't have that same mentality.
Okay. And in line with what you're saying, I'm going to read, go ahead and finish reading verse 15, which I was holding in the bag. And he said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts. For what is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God."
Well, 1 John says, "Do not love the world or the things that are in the world." And this whole passage is talking about a contrast between the things in the world and things that are truly important, which are spiritual. And the contrast between the two and how you view it, the things in the world in regard to a true view of what you should be doing for that which is eternal.
Yes, it's the conflict and the contrast between the two. What's really important, the eternal, and what's not as important, the physical world. And the only reason the physical world is important is because of how we steward it, how responsible we are with it. And it's not the love of the world and the love of the things of the world. Before we close, I do want to make a comment on situational ethics. When I read this, I understand that some people get hung up on this and they start getting into the idea of situational ethics. This parable is not a plug for situational ethics. And I'm saying that more for the people who are listening in online to make sure that that's really understood. Because Jesus does not state that any of the characters acted morally. I think I mentioned that before, but I want to emphasize that here at the end. That Jesus does not say that any of them acted morally. He doesn't commend the actions of the steward himself. He only mentions that master commended the action of the steward. And that was for the point, I think, of pointing out that the master, even the master, was worldly and had a worldly look at things. And even he was a bit of a rascal. So before I read, I got one thing I want to read out of Lewis Rushmore's book. It's the Parable of Our Lord, Volume 2. And that's kind of what I've been using as a backdrop for the classes. But before I do, does anybody have any comments they'd like to make? Yes, sir. Harry.
There's a difference between the world and sons of the world, and then those in the church, the sons of light.
Yes, there is a difference between those who are sons of the world and the members of the church, and sons of the light.
Then the difference between unrighteous manna and true riches.
Yes. Okay,
the world emphasizes unrighteous manna.
So
weird emphasizes the true riches.
Amen. Right.
Well, in all this part of chapter 16 leads up to the story of rich man and Lazarus.
Yes.
Which is, in fact, I think, kind of explaining what all these things are talking about is that attitude of life the rich man had. He was always about money. He was always about business. He was always about doing, things in this world, which was not a problem. Where Lazarus, on the other hand, didn't have those kind of things, but put his trust in God, and he received the reward.
Okay. So just for the benefit of those who are streaming this, he's referring to chapter 16, verse 19, the rich man and Lazarus, and how all these parables that are written right here lead up to that, talking about the idea that what's after is much more important than what's now. I know I paraphrased that terribly. All right, so this is what Rushmore, he concludes, or one of his concluding statements in this book that I really liked, and I don't want to try to paraphrase it and mess it up. So I'm going to close with this passage. It's page 85 if anybody wants to take a look at it. It truly is astounding, though, that probably each of us fails to fully appreciate the intensity with which we should pursue heavenly habitations. Only with great difficulty sometimes do the children of God, with the mind's eye, clearly envision the heavenly horizon. However, we must arise above the mundane and often profane existence to which mortals are accustomed, to earnestly grasp things intangible and eternal. It is a difficult lesson, but we must learn that greater heavenly heights are achieved in part by the proper use and not abuse of earthly resources. And he goes on to say, with this parable, Jesus teaches that men of the world often act with more forethought with respect to worldly affairs than the children of God do with respect to spiritual affairs. We must convince ourselves, if Christians really believe that they will one day give an accounting to God, this conviction will show up in their lives, in their use of time, talents, and treasures. That's interesting timing. So with that, we conclude the class, unless anybody wants to make any comments before we go. All right. Thank you for your time.